Mac Reeves, who might get a warm reception amongst architects and designers. Presenting in rooms like this always makes me a bit nervous, because if I say something controversial, it's a lot of people to get through to get to the door. So thank you for this invitation to speak this morning. What I'm going to try and do is take you through the way that we approach offsetting and offset's role in the context of auditing, emissions reductions, and other kinds of practices. And some elements will, I'll skirt over quite quickly. We can take some more detailed questions on it. What I want to leave you with is a sense of why I think offsets have an important role to play as one element of climate policy, and to give you some examples of some of the kinds of projects we've been involved in this region. So just in case anybody in this room had any doubts about the reasons of doing something about climate change, and I suspect I'm talking to a more sympathetic audience on the climate change front, there's a few things that we should consider when we're talking about the justifications of doing something on climate change. One is that despite the fact there's now very strong evidence, the scale, the magnitude, the direction of climate change impacts are still largely not understood at the regional or even on the continental scale. So we know that climate change is something that's happening, but translating those impacts into what this means for BC is really much more of an art and craft than a science. So the imperative under those conditions is to make good, no-regrets decisions. On the design side of buildings, we've been doing some work within my centre looking at how you manage adaptation policy in areas like Richmond and the city of Vancouver. So how do you design at the neighbourhood scale and at the municipal scale for the huge uncertainties around the likely impacts of climate change? So you choose no regrets options. You choose options, particularly on the mitigation side, where it makes a lot of sense to do it anyway, where there are other drivers that align with climate as a signal that help make a difference. The second thing is consumer perception is really driving awareness of climate change. 26 to 31% of Canadians now believe that climate change and environment are the most significant issue facing Canada. But the other thing to remember is what's really driving a lot of climate policy at the moment is the massive increase in the cost of oil over the last 3 years. I remember when I came to BC in the late 90s, there was a time when you could buy gas for 39 cents a litre. And so a lot of what's creating kind of acute pressure on energy use at the moment, as we all understand, is the increase in energy services and energy costs. And obviously that aligns very significantly with climate change goals. One might say that the rise in the tripling of oil prices over the last 5 or 6 years, is one of the most important climate policies. And to put it into context, the BC's carbon tax, when it's rolled out to its full $30 a ton, anybody know what the increase in the cost per litre of gasoline is going to be at $30 a ton? Take a guess.
Between 1 and 2 cents.
It's about 7 cents a litre at $30 a ton. So at the moment, the $10 a ton charge on gas is about 2.4 cents a litre. So if you put that in the context of the average changes in gas prices in North America over the last 10 years, the carbon tax is a much smaller price signal than just scarcity issues and risk issues that have changed the nature of oil and gas markets. So that's one of the things that's really driving awareness of climate change and of energy efficiency issues, and it's very difficult to separate out from the other ones. It's clear we're reaching the end of cheap oil, and so the most recent analysis I saw last week was suggesting prices could go up to and over $120 a barrel. It doesn't mean the end of oil. What it means is the end of that cheap, conventional, accessible oil that we've all got used to being able to hold, despite Brazil's bonanza find last week, which will actually only come online in about 10 years. We are really reaching the end of that cheap oil. We know a lot about the health and air quality exposure issues related to fossil fuel dependence. I helped coordinate a study last summer of Canada's 27 largest cities looking at the sustainability of their transport systems and air quality indicators and a range of other indicators, and we came up with this ranking of the I have to tell you, I started the study not knowing there were 27 large cities in Canada. Apparently large includes cities of about 125,000 people all the way up to places the size of Toronto. But one of the things we found there is a lot of what's driven particularly transportation energy policy hasn't been climate change, hasn't really even been innovation or technology, has really been the California effect in that market. So health and exposure issues align very tightly with many of the climate issues. Geopolitics, for me, this is one of the most important ones. You know, it's pretty clear that guaranteeing access to oil and gas internationally has something to do with a number of recent conflicts and conflicts over the last 20 or 30 years. So the geopolitics of oil and gas dependence are a big issue, and the human impacts of that are immediate and enormous. So if you need any extra reasons, if you're a doubter about climate change, here's a sort of a bundle of other ones that you might want to look to. And of course, there's, you know, there are good arguments that diversifying the economic base away from just relying on a single input into the economy, you know, is driving many of those, much of development, probably makes sense to do. Oops. To give you the sort of quick rundown on Canadian liabilities, and these align pretty closely with U.S. liabilities as well. Canada's emissions grew by about 26% between the Kyoto base layer 1990 and 2005. That's 758 megatons overall. If you divide all emissions, including industrial and residential emissions, it's about 23.5 tons per capita. If we look at things like transportation emissions, that was the fastest growing category in that period, 32%, and 110% increase in the number of light trucks on the roads in that period. So very, very rapid growth in some areas. And the reason I put this slide up is, if you can see in the transportation sector a 32% growth over a 15-year period of something that has a relatively short turnover in terms of use, that's motor vehicles, relatively short compared to buildings and roads, you can see a trend in that direction in 15 years, then my view is you can see a trend in the opposite direction just as quickly, if not faster. So there's no reason why we can't talk about 30% reductions in emissions over a 10-year period. We're seeing significant costs associated with oil prices, but what we also see is that consumers, and by this I mean individual consumers, buildings, organizations, governments, universities, are all locked into emissions trajectories that are a function of the way they've decided to build buildings, their siting decisions, the kind of motor fleet that they build, and the kind of business that they're in. So while there are some areas where they can make significant reductions in the short term, you know, in a 3 to 5 year timescale, securing 30 to 50% reductions in emissions if you're a business is pretty difficult to do. Some more detailed examples. If you return flight to Toronto, if you include the full impacts of emissions, which is what our calculator does, our calculator includes the extra impact of emissions from flying at what's called the tropopause, where the impacts have of basically running an engine creating very high temperature emissions, not necessarily the CO2 but the nitrous oxides, doubles the impact of emissions for each kilometre you travel. It's about 1.5 tonnes per passenger for that return trip. If you drive a Honda Civic, 20,000 kilometres a year, 3.2 tonnes of CO2. If you think you can avoid CO2 emissions completely, and you know I cycle as much as I can, had a nice ride down here today dodging traffic, just standing still for a year and just breathing, 350 kilograms of CO2. If you breathe heavily and you exercise too much, fit people are an enormous climate liability, I have to tell you. You could probably double that if you're on the exercise machine every day. So, this is one of my favourite statistics, and it was inspired by that, you know, that great angry uncle of Canadian commentary, Rex Murphy, on Cross Country Checkup one Sunday afternoon, when he was sort of railing against any attempt to address climate change, and he sounded like this sort of little angry hobbit in the Vale. And he was saying, you know, Canada's such a small country. Our liabilities, our emissions are so small. Why should we try and do anything about it when America's so big and China's so huge and India's got all these people? You know, why should we try and do something about it? So what I did was take Canada's per capita emissions and convert those emissions into the number of Indian citizens and Chinese citizens you would need at their emissions levels to match Canada's emissions. So Canada emits as much as 220 million average Chinese citizens and 620 million Indian citizens, so 50% of the population of India. You put it in that context, and while our population is small, our overall liabilities are 50% of the global liabilities of India. So let me give you some of the options within the current market. Again, if you want, there's lots of great detailed scholarship that's been produced on this in the last couple of years. There's a great study by the World Bank a great study by the UN on environmental services. The global carbon market now for trading is worth about $30 billion, but the vast majority of that's in the EU emissions trading scheme, which is a cap and trade scheme. In 2006, the voluntary market was about $100 million globally. What you see a lot of and what we see in the Western Climate Initiative are these regional initiatives. There's one here, there's one involving six northeastern states in US and Canada. And they're much softer instruments, they're much more difficult to manage, they have problems with leakage, but they do show some sort of basic leadership in this space. What we saw up until fairly recently was very limited technical certification and very little emphasis on sustainability. And the whole biofuels issue in Europe has really been an issue of, most recently, of optimizing or maximizing for an environmental performance criteria, which is to reduce CO2 emissions, and forgetting that, you know, significant increases in biofuels have a part of the reason for some of the increasing food security issues globally now. So you can't maximize just for environmental benefits. If you did that, you'd liquidate all kinds of old growth forest and tropical forest and just plant fast-growing eucalyptus everywhere. You know, you have to assess the impacts of some of these alternative energy projects on a kind of comprehensive and sustainability basis. And we're only just starting to see that kind of analysis. And what we tried to do in offsetters is to anticipate those kinds of evaluations becoming more regulated and just build it into the way that we sourced offsets from the start. Many of you know this already. BC's made a very aggressive move. I would argue it's the fastest moving jurisdiction on climate policy in the world at the moment. It's moved quickly in the last 12 months and very aggressively through a series of policies to position itself as a leading jurisdiction. We're seeing about $1 billion of investment over 4 years for climate, a number of new initiatives, a green building code, a carbon tax, and a commitment to a carbon neutral government for air travel and scope one emissions, and then investment in what's called the Innovative Clean Energy Fund. It's really changed the game in BC in the last 6 months in a way that I think is very interesting. To put offsets in context, you have to think of a string of decisions or processes you have to engage with. The first thing that all the organizations that we work with have to do is to conduct some level of auditing of their existing liabilities. You know, what's their inventory? What's their stock of carbon offset liabilities? Because it's very difficult for them to make any claims without knowing first what their baseline is. So the first stage in this is that you audit. The second stage is that you develop a comprehensive strategy for your organization. The third stage is that you aim to reduce your emissions. And the fourth stage is for the emissions that you can't reduce cost effectively, you look at offsets. And you look at offsets relative to the goals of your organization. So I chaired UBC's recent greenhouse gas audit. Our full liabilities, and we went much further than the provincial government required us to or many people expected us to. UBC as a small municipality has about 67,000 tons of emissions related to burning gas on campus to create heat, about 23,000 tons for electricity, about 14,000 tons a year approximately for corporate travel, for flights, for academics to go to the other side of the world to present for 20 minutes as I try to do with less and less often these days. Commuting liabilities are probably about 24,000 tons. But then we also looked at the liabilities that are embedded in buildings. So we tried to work out, we all know that when you build buildings, there's a significant energy footprint from the construction costs, independent of the direct emissions from their operation. You assume a climate liability when you build a new building. And what you typically do is amortize that liability over a reasonable lifetime of the building. So that's usually 30 or 50 years. And when we did that for the total square footage of UBC and then amortized it over the lifetime, we figured there's about 12,000 tons per year of CO2 embedded within all of the buildings on campus. So that's just to give you a high-level strategy. And we know UBC's gone a long way in reducing its emissions, and they also, you know, they now have a very strong incentive to reduce, for instance, those gas emissions from the steamworks. Voluntary offsets fill a gap in the market where regulators are slow or where companies want to, you know, demonstrate leadership. The high-quality version of offsets, the ones that we're really interested in, really argue that what you're trying to do is pool funds to create economies of a scale for emissions reductions. And we argue that for larger scale initiatives, there are lots of opportunities in the economy to do this. So let me just take you through an example of this. Let's assume this is what we're looking at, six people's homes, and they do an audit of their homes and they decide to reduce their emissions as much as they can in a given year. So they do the audit, they develop a strategy, and they reduce their emissions magically down to, let's say, 75% of the emissions in the previous year. But you start within that process over 2 or 3 years to hit real cost factors. So there are some easy things that you can do, but when you hit maybe 20 to 30% of emissions reductions, it starts to become expensive to secure the next ones. But maybe you're not satisfied with that. Maybe you want to go further. What you can then do is identify a large-scale building, let's say a community center, a community building, a church. Greenhouses is an area that we've been looking at a lot recently. And you say, the most cost-effective thing I can do as my next stage is to pool my investment with six other building owners and invest in an emissions reduction project in a large industrial facility or a community building or something else. By pooling that investment, I reduce their emissions and I claim those offsets. And it's really as simple as that. And the role of an organization like Offset is to be the intermediary, to do the third-party certification, to pool the funds and to find strategic ways of investing in, you know, basically in making this change, moving from this position to this position. On the quality side of things, we've generally found, we know there are ways of doing tree planting that can produce real offsets. I'm very careful not to be critical of every tree planting scheme, but it's very clear that in the early history of offsets, there are some really dodgy tree planting schemes that were qualifying as offsets. And in the worst case scenario, what's happening is you'll get tree planting that would have happened anyway, and what they're doing is adding on a small surcharge or charging a consumer a rent effectively for the additional, for what they're claiming is offsets. Those offsets where the energy efficiency savings or the emissions reductions would have occurred anyway are not additional. That's the critical technical criteria. So you need to demonstrate that that expenditure secures reductions that wouldn't have occurred without the offset investment. The strongest global standard is called the gold standard. It was developed by WWF, the conservation organization, not the wrestlers. But it doesn't apply to projects, and it cannot apply to projects that are secured in Canada. So it only applies to non-Kyoto countries. WRI, the World Resources Institute, has developed a very robust reporting and auditing framework that we use. ISO has a standard that the CSA has just formalized in Canada. And again, the trick here is to use some kind of third-party verifier or engineer who can ensure that when you're making claims both about the scale of the offset reductions and their additionality, that an external engineering firm signs off on it. And when we looked at this, we've been working very closely with Vancity. We helped them secure their carbon neutral status just last week. They'd found an engineer who satisfied all their criteria. We figured if it's good enough for Vancity, then it's good enough for any other buyer in the market. So we work with their engineer to do the verifying. This is what our current website looks like. We tried to inject a little bit of humor into offsetting. This is the Climate Change Weight Loss Club. I lost 2 tons in 1 day. Join me. I mean, if you can't laugh about climate change, what can you laugh about, really? I mean, really, this is trying to get us away from carbon offsets being a kind of voluntary taxation scheme to it being a kind of identity, a brand and identity people feel that they can rally around and organize themselves around. So it was meant to be a kind of positive lifestyle choice in this space. And as the new website rolls out over the next week or two, we're going to maintain that sort of sense of humor about this. Make it accessible, make it simple for people. Our local projects are ground source heat pumps in 5 municipal and community buildings across BC. If you look on our website, you can see some details of those. We'll approach a community building, a community organization. We either know that they're looking at ground source heat pumps or a similar technology, but they can't afford them, or we'll actually approach them directly and strategically and say, we think you're a good candidate for this kind of project. We'll help them secure funds. We'll subsidize the cost of those funds by, for instance, just paying some of the mortgage interest. And we'll help them transition to a lower carbon strategy. And this is really important for community organizations that are cash constrained and can't necessarily secure the funds to make those transitions. We've been looking at major energy efficiency upgrades in the agricultural sector around greenhouses, for instance. We can help reduce their emissions by between 30 and 70% by helping them invest in basically in insulation technologies and alternatives to gas. And again, there's, you know, all the great well-established green technologies that many of us know should be going into many buildings already. So things like solar thermal, grey water heat recovery, ground source heat pumps at the right scale all make great sense for these buildings. The first generation of offsets we talk about were really the building a tax into a service. So it's a surcharge by a travel agent, or it's a commission system like the system we have set up with WestJet, or it's a promotional system where, for instance, one of the Honda sales rooms dealerships offered 3 tons of CO2 with every new car that sold. On this model, we set up, helped Harbour Air become the world's first climate neutral airline. When we did their audit and helped them develop a strategy, we found that the CO2 emissions from flying to Victoria on their seaplanes were about 50% of the emissions of driving out to the ferry, going across on the ferry, and driving off at the other end. So they were already a greener option for many of the examples of travel that people would look at. But we also found that they could reduce their emissions to zero for about 50 cents a ticket. So they originally started out with a voluntary program, and at some point I convinced the CEO that they should just roll it into their ticket price, that there's real value in showing leadership in this space. And the value to them is showing leadership as the world's first climate-neutral airline. They're also, you know, the world's largest seaplane fleet, so it's not insignificant. Vancity went through this audit strategy reduce and offset route. Their emissions are around 6,000 tonnes, reduced the remainder through some projects that we helped them support, and then also invested in audits of 25 businesses in and around BC. But what we're seeing with offsets is an evolution of offset mechanisms into what I call second-generation offsets, where they're really kind of bundled into the pricing structures of goods. The consumer doesn't necessarily have to make an extra transaction. Consumers, for the most part, are a little bit lazy when it comes to assuming extra costs, even if they think it's the right thing to do. So we're looking at mortgages that include green criteria. We're looking at home equity loans and how we can help leverage those for improving the performance of buildings. Loans to developers that help bridge that sort of gap between developer wanting to build and get out quickly, and a bit of developer who isn't as concerned about the operational costs of the buildings. Discounted schemes for green vehicles, incentive schemes around that. Credit card affinity cards, which we've looked at length, and redemption schemes. We have a redemption program with Vancity that allows you to redeem your points for offsets. And then a range of different insurance and merchandising options. And you're seeing this in Europe. You're seeing carbon neutrality being built into these kinds of products in many spaces. And I think we're going to see it much more here over the next few years. That's it.
Oh, great.
Thank you.